When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving podcast. Okay, it is Tuesday the 5th of March. Welcome to episode 106 of the show. Thank you for all the great feedback to last week's episode with T. Williams. That was a really great episode, I have to say. One of my favourites. It was really great to be able to dig into so many of those stories from the early grime era, but also the early jungle era. I mean, we're obviously of similar ages, myself and T. Williams. And, well, you know, it's always nice to be able to compare notes, isn't it, about formative experiences. And yeah, that early jungle scene, early drum and bass, as it moved through the 90s, that was just, it was a lot of fun to be a part of, even as a kind of, you know, as a punter, as it were. Yeah, great to be able to relive some of those memories. And also, you know, dig into the more contemporary topical stuff too. So yeah, that was a great episode and I know lots of you enjoyed it. So yeah, double thumbs up to you for your feedback and double thumbs up to T. Williams for being such a great guest last week. This week on the show, it's a little bit of a different vibe. So the majority of the guests we've had on over the last 105 episodes have been roughly of my generation. That is to say, people who grew up in the 90s and came to musical prominence in the 2000s or thereabouts, whatever part of that decade. But yeah, people who are on that sort of timeline. Now, we've had a few exceptions to that. The one I think is most relevant to today's conversation was, I think, Adrian Sherwood, who I guess is, about 20 years older than I am or thereabouts. So therefore, you know, born in the 60s, growing up in the 70s, coming to wider prominence in the 80s. And that is basically true for Alex Patterson, today's guest. Now, Alex is most well known for being the only constant member of the biggest ambient group of all time. I don't think that's an exaggeration. They're certainly the only ambient group to have reached the stage of playing, you know, major main stage festival shows. They went on after Peter Gabriel closing Woodstock in 1994. Like, just think about that for a moment. I mean, obviously, Brian Eno is commonly credited for inventing the ambient genre, but I mean, I don't think he ever reached the scale doing that kind of stuff that the Orb did in the 90s. So this is absolutely seminal electronic music stuff here. And Alex Patterson, as I said, yeah, he's the only common thread through that project, which started in the late 80s. And last released an album pretty recently, last year. In fact, the last Orb album was. So as I'm implying, there's been various different lineups along the way. So I'm just going to give you a little potted history of the people involved in the Orb, because actually during the conversation, people get referred to, and it's one of those ones where it was just difficult to kind of clarify along the way. So the Orb currently is Alex Patterson and Michael Rendell, who's of a younger generation, is a relatively recent addition. But the kind of classic lineup, I suppose, was Alex and Thrash, aka Chris Weston, who's a guy who's got all sorts of great recording and remix credits down the years. But yeah, Alex and Thrash were the kind of key duo, I suppose, maybe. But in addition to that, Martin Glover, aka Youth, who was also the bass player in The Killing Joke, is a key person here and is referred to in the conversation without any other explanation. Also, Andy Faulkner was part of the group in the 90s, and he is also part of Cedibus with Alex Patterson, who are basically the reason why we had this conversation. Cedibus have a new album out, and that was the basis that Alex came on the show to ostensibly sell that album. Additionally, Thomas Fellman, who is an unbelievably great producer from Germany, was part of the Orb in the 90s until, well, for quite a long time, actually, in the 90s into the 2000s. And probably most importantly, in terms of the formation of the Orb and the kind of sonic approach that the Orb has taken over the years, Jimmy Courty of the KLF was the founding member with Alex Patterson. So obviously the KLF are something that we've talked about quite a bit on the show, and I would have a long-standing ambition to get one of those guys on the show to kind of talk about it in more detail. But yeah, Jimmy Courty was, yeah, part of the Orb from day one, but actually left pretty early. We don't really talk about that, but yeah, there's so many interesting stories, of course, on a career that is this long. Now, this was a conversation which took a little bit of work to get into shape. It's obviously shorter than normal, but it's still over an hour. But as I mentioned at the start of the conversation, Alex Patterson and interviews have historically been a little bit of a difficult one. If you want to dig into his interview history, they're mostly characterized by him not really getting on with his interviewer. And particularly, I think it's fair to say that he doesn't like journalists very much. And to be honest, regular listeners will know that that doesn't put him at odds with the general vibe of this show. Anyway, as I mentioned, Cedibus is the reason that we're having this conversation. There's a new album called SETI, which is out now. As I said, Alex Patterson and Andy Faulkner is that project. But of course, The Orb was something I wanted to talk about in detail too, and we definitely do that in many different facets, from the philosophy of copyright and sampling in music, to playing ambient on big festival stages, to getting started in the 80s with the project, and also his prior history to that too. I mean, there's a lot in this conversation, even if it is just an hour. And an hour is still a decent amount of time, isn't it? So yeah, let's get into it, shall we? Just before that, in fact, you'll have heard at the top that you can get rid of the ads with Patreon. Join up at Patreon. It's $4 a month, £3.50 for the lowest tier. Patreon.com/scubaofficial. You can also support the show if you don't want to subscribe by the means of a one-off donation, scubaofficial.io/support. There is now an Ethereum donation button up there. So if you're crypto literate, and I know lots of you are, you can support us via ETH at scubaofficial.io/support. If you're not able to financially get involved here, that's completely fine, completely understand. The best two things you can do, actually, are leaving us a review. I really like reading reviews, but actually it helps the algorithm too on these podcast platforms. And follow the show. Hit the follow button wherever you listen to this podcast. And I do like reading gushing reviews, actually. I have to say, I might hold my hands up and say I do enjoy reading those. So do that too. There's a Spotify playlist you can follow. Link in the show notes to that playlist. And also you can join us on the Discord, hotfoshrecordings.com/discord. Anyone can join that server, and we'd love to see you there. Okay, this has been a long intro. So, without further delay, here is Alex Patterson of The Orb. Alex Patterson, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah, this is not a new experience, just a new experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, I've been reading your previous interviews, and I think we share a suspicion of journalists, and I'm not a journalist, so let's just establish that up the front. You're in the offices of Cooking Vinyl, is that right?
Yep, apparently so. Yeah, that is right, yeah. I wouldn't call them offices, but that's just what they do, yeah. They're just
okay.
21st century offices.
So, but you actually run a label through them now, I understand.
That's correct, yeah. Obscure.
So what has been your experience running a label in today's music landscape such as it is?
Well, it's been quite successful so far, touch wood. I wouldn't say it was like a massive record label. The name Obscure, by definition, is meant to be hard to find. I mean, not trying to sell the record as such. I mean, here I am selling a record.
Right.
I don't do this very often, so.
Sure, but I mean, you do release quite a lot on the label, though, right? There's quite a lot that's in the catalogue.
Yeah, sure. Well, I would say twice a year, but that's not a lot, but then it is a lot.
Right.
If you get my drift.
Sure.
If I could do something every week, then I would, but that's not really the nature of the beast of the record label. They like bands to do one album a year, or maybe two if they're lucky. Or if you become big enough, you do an album every other year, or it'd be even bigger, do an album every 5 years and milk the other out of that album for 5 years. I've been around the block, I understand how it all works. And with the label itself, yeah, I've just got to sort of kick my heels, and I'm looking at two albums that are coming out the year after next.
Sure.
That's kind of how it has to work.
So the Cedibus record, which you are, as you say, trying to sell right now. Tell me a bit about that. The project is with Andy Falconer, who was obviously part of The Orb back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me about the project generally, because there was an album that came out in 21, right?
Yeah, we remained friends for all that time. And I kind of bumped into him at a party festival in Spain about 4 years ago. And we decided to do the first album, which was very successful. It came out the same time as I had a book coming out the same month. And they kind of piggybacked each other, which is pretty cool. This time round, it seems to have its own little life of its own, where people are interested because of the first album. And we've already had some really good reviews without even looking for people to review it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, sure.
I think there's a certain amount of people out there that can remember the old Orb stuff that was done on the first album. And it's kind of relevant still 30-odd years later, which is really odd, but it's true.
So, yeah, I sort of see why you could say that it's odd. But actually, I think that, you know, dance music now is actually quite nostalgic. And something like, you know, the first Orb albums, you know, that's like seminal material. Like, I mean, it's kind of hallowed ground at this point. So I think, you know, I think people looking back now, it makes sense to me that it would be, you know, the new stuff, which it kind of harks back to that, would make sense to people, you know?
Yeah, when you're talking to someone who's really close to it, like, I've kind of lived it.
Sure.
Big time, as opposed to just putting it on the shelf and then taking it out now and again to listen to. Say, like a Black Dog album, or a B12, or Aphex Twin. For me, that's all what you're saying would make complete sense, but as sitting there as the Orb, I'm on top of it.
Right, yeah, sure.
So it's kind of quite literally on top of it.
Yeah, you have no perspective, I suppose, you know. It's
no,
a difficult
not
thing
really.
To...
I try to have perspective, but how can you have perspective on your own stuff?
Sure.
Because there's a thing called ego that's involved in there. And I don't want to sound like I'm an egotistic bastard, because I'm not. I try very hard not to sell my own music. And it does... As I've always said, it's done very well on its own without actually having to make it look like I'm trying to sell my own music. But here I am, selling my own music. In a nice way. I mean, this album was very simply set, very, very easily put together. There's only 5 tracks. 40 minutes of music, a bonus track that's 12 minutes long. That's not like an Orb album where we're trying to cram everything in to one CD and having a double album that's around 70 minutes.
Yep.
And that's not really trying to tell something that was quantity rather than quality. It was trying to keep both of those perspectives open and having an idea that you can use your 70 minutes wisely by splitting those 70 minutes into 20 minutes of dance music, hip-hop, reggae, ambience. You've got your selection of music, the 4 sides of music of a record to do that. And thank God records have come back into fashion again.
Right.
Because there was a time when everyone was selling, throwing out vinyl. You go down the West End and you just see skips, quite literally skips of vinyl thrown out by record shops because they didn't know how to sell them anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. Dark days.
And now it's suddenly 50 quid for a brief David Bowie album because it's a repress. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah. So I was just going to say, obviously there was an Orb album last year too, and Zedibus is, you know, two members of the Orb. So how do you distinguish between the two projects? I mean, obviously people come to an Orb record, you know, with a lot of preconceptions, right? They, you know, they're bringing baggage to it because of the history. So how do you see the two projects interacting with each other, if at all?
Well, the Orb now is Michael Rendell and myself. What we do, what I do with it's kind of an extreme ambient version of all the ambient stuff that we'd have done on the first album, which would have included a huge ever-growing Pulse Lighting Brain, which is the very first thing we ever really did that broke us.
Sure.
And that was a 19 minute track in the middle of a techno house revolution. We decided to go completely the other way. But we knew what we were doing there in the sense that we knew that people had to chill out at some point in that day. They weren't always on a 4-4 all night bouncing about.
Right, so was it very calculated, that, on your part?
Well, to a certain degree, yeah. I mean, I've always liked ambient music. I came from a label before all this that was EG Records, where you'd find a lot of ambient bands. Not DJs, but actual bands like Penguin Cafe Orchestra.
Sure.
Frippertronics. There were all elements of ambience in there. And that was my job, was to pick the good pieces of music and put them on the vinyl for the artist as an A&R man.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me the... not the credibility, but it gave me the confidence to say, okay, I can do this myself. I don't need an A&R man telling me what to do when I go and put these records out, because none of those people understand what I'm doing in the first place.
Sure.
Unless they were at EG. And EG was doing it very well. And I was just part of a cog. And my cog got bigger as I worked with the Orb. And I was blessed with two albums that really did turn my life upside down. And with the confidence that I had, I didn't need an A&R man telling me what to do. Simple.
Right.
And that's not an ego thing, it's just the way it was. It's kind of how I saw life. I saw things from, as a roadie, I saw life completely differently, working with Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm.
I may never have survived that to do what I'm doing today. But I did. And they never did any ambient stuff apart from maybe one track on the third album where he was drunk with a little click track singing about his teddy bear.
If I can just interrupt you, I was reading about your sessions in Berlin with The Killing Joke, and you were talking about going outside and taking field recordings and bringing them back into the studio and not getting credited for that. But
yeah, totally. But that's always been Killing Joke. I was the blonde kid who was whooping because I was doing disco whoops under a track called Malicious Boogie.
Yeah.
But I got no credit whatsoever and I still haven't. And I don't expect to ever get any credit from Killing Joke because that's just the way they were.
Sure.
Doing versions of Sex Pistols songs. I enjoyed myself doing it. I was like 19, 20 years old. I was riding a crest of a wave, which was called punk at the time, post-punk. And again, I fitted in quite nicely to all that. I had the right pedigree. I went to art school. Not the same one as Malcolm McLaren, but the same one as the Bromley contingent and Banshees and Gen X.
Which one was that? Which school was that?
It's called Ravensbourne.
Yep.
Which is Bromley.
Yeah, in London, right? Yeah.
And that was the eye-opener for me, going there from a boarding school in Oxfordshire that was all male, going to an art school, there was three girls to every one boy.
Right, yeah. Actually, I read that you were somewhat of a wayward teenager. Is that right? if I can put it like that.
We don't talk about that with old people now, and I'm a granddad and stuff. I can't be letting my grandchildren know this sort of stuff. Yeah, apparently a little bit. Yeah, I mean, yeah, one parent. When you're brought up with a one parent, and wayward, and maybe I was, I didn't conform. That's basically what I would say about myself now.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I knew what I wanted, and I got what I wanted. I wanted to be an artist, and here I am, still being an artist. I'm doing the artwork for Syllabus, the album covers. That's me. I'm very happy with myself in that level. All I ever wanted to do was do one album cover and think, oh, that's it, I made it, when I was little.
Really? That's fascinating.
I won't even say how many album covers I've done now, but... Or being lazy, you get your own idea and you get someone else to do that idea.
Sure. Let me ask you, at what point when you were a kid... Did that crystallise in your head, this is what I want to do, you know? Because I think it's different, certainly for many people that I've talked to, myself as well. Like, I had that kind of vague idea in my head that I wanted to be in that space, you know, which is to say music, or, you know, the quote-unquote creative industries, as people say now. Obviously, didn't think about it like that then. But do you remember, was there a point at which you realised that?
I was blessed maybe with the fact that I lost my dad quite early on in life. I had an older brother who I thought was my dad.
Right.
And we were very close. And there was... And the closeness became closer and closer the older we got. When I was 11, 12 years old, he was taking me to pubs around South London because he was in a band. And I was thinking, wow, I'd love to do this. This is... But then I wanted to do art. And I won a competition when I was like 9 years old for the Green Cross Code man.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
And I did a painting. Yeah, exactly. But these little things. Then I had my name in lights as a 9 year old. Didn't have my name on it, but a young lad from Battersea, created this bit of artwork, and he's won an award. That was me. And I was like, wow. That's what I want to do. And I got into graphic design really early on because of that.
It's really interesting. Sorry if I can just interrupt you. It's really interesting you put it like that, because was it the art or was it the recognition, do you think, looking back? And just caveating what you've said about having an ego, but like the way you tell that story is like, it's almost, maybe it's half and half, but you know.
No, I think I suppose it was a young ego.
Right.
There, to being honest, but at the same point, I know that through all my secondary education, I was in the arts class from the shop. I had an art tutor that really took into what I was doing and taught me lots of ways of using charcoal, using colours, and using just blacks and whites, greys, and learning about art. And that then took me to art school.
Sure.
Well, I was having massive arguments. Not because I was wayward, it's because I had ideas. I wasn't just following their ideas. They didn't want me to paint it with liquid rubber. I wanted to paint with liquid rubber.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Everything that was negative was positive, or the other way around.
Sure.
And that came out with the music.
Yeah, when did music become an important thing then? Because, like, as you said, like, you know, you said artist, but you really specifically meant visual art, right?
Yeah, for sure. The musical art became really when Killing Joke was formed.
Right.
And I got the short straw. I was the mate who was the roadie.
Okay.
And all the other mates were in the band.
Right.
And that taught me a lot of things there. Like egos.
What year are we in? Sorry, if I can just interrupt you. What?
We're in now in 1979.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah, carry on.
78, I was still at art school. I was full-on punk rocker. I loved all the reggae. I loved reggae anyway, but I grew up with punk as a first-generation punk rocker from 77. Mm. I wasn't in with the in crowd, but I got to know the in crowd because I was in the Orb, and but people like Jar Wobble were playing bass with the Orb.
Right.
Imagine how it felt for me. That was just the icing on the cake here.
Totally.
Johnny Rotten turning up to an Orb gig, coming up with one of the best comments about the band, which is, the Orb are beautifully boring. I mean, millions, there's just waiting goals shit going on here. Beautiful stuff.
Okay, so we've jumped ahead a bit there. So back to...
Sorry about that, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's all right. Back to being a roadie for Killing Joke. We actually had Adrian Sherwood on the show, and he gave us a great account of this exact period and him being involved in, him being really into punk and also into the reggae scene and the early dub scene in the UK. So I guess this is a similar sort, and this is obviously in London too, right?
Mm-hmm. He was in East London.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So tell me about what were your duties as a roadie for the Killing Joke initially?
What were my duties?
Yeah.
Great. keep them intact, stop them from fighting, stop them being hurt, make music, make fucking funny noises for them to use on records.
Had you been to school with youth? Did I read that right?
Yeah, I was his prefect at school.
Oh, were you? Wow. Oh, right. Mm. Okay, so there was a kind of...
completely different. It's just not just any old mate. I was actually... when we were little, I was much bigger than him, if that makes sense. And I basically just made sure he wasn't bullied at school. And I'm quite proud of that, because his younger brother, who went to the same school, he went, "Patterson, you're all right at school, you didn't bully me." And he's 6 foot fucking four now, and he was in the... Not the SAS, but the SBS. He was in the special boat control.
Right. Yeah.
And... I didn't really want him like bothering me, saying I was a bully when I was younger, which I wasn't. So, and it just proved to myself that, you know, I might have got into a few fights, but they were not always my fault.
Right.
That's going back to school.
Yeah, sure.
And Killing Joke was the same thing. You know, you just knew which member of the band not to get in a fight with, and that was Big Paul, the drummer. He was 6 foot 3, it was a triple Aries and a nutter. If you said something out of place, you got wanked. And that's why a lot of roadies couldn't work with Killing Joke, because they couldn't take the physical side of it all.
Is that right? Okay. Fair enough.
Which is fair enough, yeah.
Yeah, I read that you first met Thomas Fellman around this time in Berlin. Is that right?
Many years later, but...
is it later? Okay.
It was 89.
Oh, 89. Yeah, okay. So that was a misprint. There's an interview with you where it says 79 for that, and I did think that doesn't quite make sense. But
no, that wouldn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay.
He was with a band called Palace Cherbourg, who became quite big players of weird, eccentric electronic music in Germany.
Yeah, I was listening to them this morning. It is quite weird stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, because he actually plays not saxophone, trumpet.
Right.
On that. Yes. Mm. Always threw me when he started playing. What are you doing? Is this you? What are you doing? And the video of him playing tennis, that was even weirder. But anyway, I shouldn't. But that was all part of, like, that brings in Morris von Oswald.
Oh, right, yeah.
Who, Basic Channel.
Mm. Yes.
He was a bit of a legend.
Absolutely is, yeah. Totally. So, I mean, let's stick on the timeline for a moment.
Mm.
You mentioned doing A&R for EG. Was that a sort of direct progression from dipping your toe in the water, so to speak, in the industry with as a roadie? But I mean, how do you get between those two, you know, jobs, as it were?
Having the confidence to say to somebody, "Give me the job,"
right?
And not, you know, and a week that weekend they had the two bosses of EG had a flim flam and decided that, okay, we'll give him a job. Me as an A&R scout. So suddenly I was given £25,000 a year and expenses.
That was good money in those days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've all the people at EG, when I left EG to carry on the Orb full time, said, you're mad. Why are you doing that?
Right.
But as I said to them, it's not about money.
So EG were quite a big, not a major, but a pretty big indie at that point, right?
They had a lot of bands that you wouldn't know that were on EG because they would be licensed to Polygram or to Ireland.
Right.
Killing Joke happened to Killing Joke back in 79. They Their first EP got licensed by Ireland in 79, the Turns of Red EP. And then in 1980, they got picked up by EG full time for a record label, as a 6-album deal. I also got a kind of part of all that because I was their roadie.
Sure.
And I think a lot of the members of Killing Joke, bless them, don't quite remember the actual proper timelines for a lot of things. I was having a conversation with Mike from Malicious Damage only this morning, who lives around the corner from here. And we're talking about that very thing about how Jazz doesn't really know which year he's talking about. Bless him. The singer in Killing Joke. And we're all saddened as brothers to lose Geordie Walker. One of the subliminal best guitarists in the world, most underrated guitarists in the world. And that was, careful now. We're all getting on, we've all got to look after ourselves. And even the youngsters have got to look after themselves, because when they get to our age, they won't last if they don't look after. Simple. But you can sell that to people, but everybody thinks they're superhuman anyway, so it doesn't matter. It's just the way we are.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Not going to happen to me.
Right.
You know, on a more kind of serious note, in the last 3 years, I've had 2 heart attacks and a stroke.
Have you? Wow. Mm. Wow. How's your health now?
Well, it's okay.
Touch wood.
It's not 100% by any means, but I'm looking after myself. And
yeah, good.
Rather than doing 5 gigs a week, I'm doing 1 or 2 gigs a week. Example.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's not nothing.
Well, I've got to make a living. It's just, I can't not make a living. It's a...
Sure.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
So how did you find working for a label, like in the industry, quote unquote? Because, I mean, as an A&R man, you're expected to deliver, right, for the company. So how did you find that?
Well, it's quite a stunningly weird moment. And it's good that you said that, because a lot of people would think, wow, you got a job where my job for EG was to tell them what was going on.
Right.
Not deliver an artist. I delivered them several artists. But they would always say no, under different grounds and reasons of saying no, but they were just being really quite annoying. But my flatmate and the band that I was in, The Orb, the other band member in The Orb, were both published by EG Records. So I didn't have a publishing deal, but Jimmy Courtney had a publishing deal, Youth had a publishing deal. Youth and I had our own label called Wow, Mr. Modo, that would...
Yep.
We popped up with several top 10 hits in our little lifetime of 2 years, the late 80s, early 90s. And The Orb I don't have to talk about, but Jimmy was the other half of The Orb. So anything we did with The Orb, they would instantly get some money for. Anything I did with the label, they'd get some money for because of Youth. So they turned their blind eye and let me get on with what I was doing. Quote unquote, this is EG telling me about dance music. Oh, don't worry about that. That'll blow over in a year. It's always been one of my...
I think someone said something similar about
it. It always cracked me up trying to say that.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Like, Here we are.
Yeah, exactly. So from your perspective, you were, I mean, it sounds like a pretty good gig, actually. You were basically free to kind of keep your ear to the ground, which I guess you would have been doing anyway.
I could go out at night. Yeah, I could go out at night, listen to music and get paid for it.
Yeah, sounds decent.
And I'll get I'll have free money to get by booze in the club and get a taxi home. On top of everything else, an expense account.
Without dipping into your 25 grand, exactly.
Yeah, and keep that, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
I wasn't complaining.
No, it sounds good. Like I said, it does sound good. So how did you meet Jimmy Courtney for the first time?
Being a roadie, working with... He was actually doing it out front, sound engineer, before he became a guitarist. Yeah, so he moved...
Yeah.
We all move in strange circles until we find our real purpose in life. And Jimmy, yeah, we got on really well. We must have done. And I was DJing with KLF. KLF were doing something else that was completely different again. All trying to rule the world, I suppose, in a quirky way.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about making music in this period. I mean, this is the kind of advent of sampling, basically. And those early KLF records and the stuff that those guys were doing was absolutely defined by the use of samples, which of course the Orb stuff is too, mm-hmm. as your lawyers no doubt have heard enough of. But what was the, what were your kind of like ideas behind that? I mean, how did this kind of, you know, sampling approach develop? I mean, what were your influences in doing it? And I mean, how were you guys thinking about it? That's a big question, I realise.
It was a really big question. I mean, trial and error, really. I mean, like, with a huge, ever-growing, pulsating brain, loving you for short, we thought we could just use Minnie Riperton and have her vocals over the top. Mm. That's how naive we were.
Right.
That's when we first had our first lawsuit after putting out 1,000 copies on our own label, thinking it was fine. In comes Mr. Lawyer. Trial and error. So we get our own vocalists in, still give them songwriting for it. It's a bit like, there must be at least 20 people on Huge Evergrowing that have been sampled or have parts of their music we put on there. Mm. But we cleared it. We knew that the problem. By the time 30 years later, when we were doing, Thomas and I were doing an ambient album, we were very proud to write on the back, no synthesizers were made in the making of this record.
Right.
Meaning that everything was sampled.
Yeah.
Try and find the sample. And that's the beauty that we're in a situation where we know how to hide those samples. AI has made it a million times better for us.
Right.
But it depends if we want to look at the positive sides of these things. You look worried then for a second.
So I have a question here, or a topic of conversation anyway, with regards to copyright, basically, and your views on, I mean, this has been a really long running debate, right? Like intellectual property and fair use for audio in making other audio. So, I mean, did you have a kind of philosophical take at any point in this early period about whether or to what extent it's okay to use other people's work to make your own art?
If it sounds good, let's change it.
Sure.
Not too much. But it doesn't sound like what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But keep the essence of that within the song. And knowing that you can change the frequency, you can change the vibrations of the sound, that it doesn't sound like what you would have... And you're talking an instrument within the record. You're not talking about a whole record itself.
Mm.
With Fluffy Clouds, it's another perfect example of plagiarism at its best. How you create a song out of other people's music, but they're all different types of music. And who comes after you when you do all that? The lawyers.
Okay.
The musicians love it.
Sure.
A perfect example was Ricky Lee Jones on Fluffy Clouds. She loved it. She just give me $5,000 for doing that. That's amazing. Thank you. Steve Reich, the rhythm for Fluffy Clouds, he came after us and said, look, I never in a million years would have expected my music to turn up like that. What have we done? That's amazing. Can I please ask for some publishing? But I don't want publishing right from the beginning. Now that I've found you, can you give us a percentage of the publishing?
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
And can you do us a remix so I can put it on a record? Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like people are after you or they're trying to say, right, we're a bunch of businessmen trying to make money out of what you're doing. Sounds like musicians who've got the right idea about music and what music can do and how you can take and transform an idea. And perfect, another idea like that, but we never got any credit for, The Shoe Is on the Other Foot, is Higher Than the Sun by Primal Scream.
Right.
Now, you listen to the demos, it's nothing like what we did. Yet we only got a point. We never got any publishing for it. So it's who's ripping off who here? And it's not like I'm trying to rip someone off.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, you use the word plagiarism, but is it really plagiarism if it's done in that kind of way?
Well, there's no difference to the Beatles or Led Zeppelin and their first albums that they did.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
One of them told the truth, the other ones didn't. And we're trying to tell the truth.
I mean, do you believe in copyright per se? I mean, some people don't. Some musicians don't at all. Do you believe in intellectual property per se?
Well, I do go down that KLF route. What's KLF, Copyright Liberation Front? that rings very clear, very true with me. And at the end of the day, the first six albums I'm still paying for, I'm still not being paid. Universal own those records and they're never going to give them back to me.
Right. Right.
They're constantly making money out of me. I'm not getting any money for it.
Sure.
Where would you go if you had that kind of business dangling over your head? How would you feel about doing music for people like that?
No, absolutely.
You wouldn't want to, really, would you? You wouldn't
think, oh, okay. Totally. Totally. 100%. There's an interview with you that I read from about 95. I think it was the Orbis Terrarum campaign. And you're talking, or maybe it's a couple of years later, actually, because you're talking about having signed to Island, having broken up with, was it Big Life?
Yeah.
And you're not happy at all in this interview at what's going on with your Island campaign. And it struck me that, you know, I mean, obviously the landscape was very different in the 90s and majors were jumping on experimental music in a way that they just don't now. But was signing to a major an obvious thing to do? Or was it just like, okay, they offered you the best deal and you took it? Or was it inevitable that you ended up a label that size?
We signed to Island, but Island got consumed by Universal.
Sure.
Island were an independent label when we first started with them.
Right.
Chris Blackwell invited me to his yacht in Jamaica.
What was that like?
Well, I declined, actually. I went and saw one of my cousins.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, mate, I'm going to go and see my cousin. I had a cousin living on the island, and I went and spent a month with my cousin and her two kids.
Fair enough.
I said, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I was still not being bothered by having an A&R man then. I still had the credibility to do my own thing there. And Mark Moreau was the head of Island Records and he took me under his wing. He could see that there was something experimentally, amazingly, something weird about the Orb that not many other bands could do.
I mean, you'd also had a lot of commercial success at that point.
Hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So I guess it's the, you know, you're right to say that Island was an independent, but it was a big independent. I mean, U2 were on Island, you know?
Yeah, sure. And that's where it all went pear-shaped when U2 signed to the Island for that reason. I think every artist on Island suffered.
Really?
When U2 did something, everything stopped and it was all U2. And then the other 10 bands that may be on island, they'd all work on a Friday afternoon just to catch up with the other bands, and the rest of the week was all U2. I mean, we did a remix for U2. Listen, they never released it because we made sure when we did the remix there was nothing of theirs on it.
Fair enough.
Because that's the way we are, and then I was quite happy to stick to the. Well, and there's no difference to what I'd done before.
Yeah.
Meaning that High in the Sun was basically the all, but Pommel Screen had a vocalist called Bobby Gillespie, and he's on there, but everything else is the boops, a harp, all samples from New York jazz bands.
Right.
Who would go near a New York jazz band in the early 90s?
Right.
Yeah, really. But write for samples, and sure. No one's going to tell you. Because they wouldn't have listened to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you about performing this stuff, because, you know, you talked about quote-unquote chill out having been calculated to a certain extent. And you guys initially DJed, you and Jimmy DJed, that was the first iteration of playing the Orb stuff in front of an audience. So, what? I mean, tell me about that. And then I want to ask you about how it migrated to big festival stages, because that's got to have been a challenge. But yeah, but tell me about playing. It was at Heaven, wasn't it? The first DJing stuff that you did.
Again, it was one of those things that was, it became legendary because people couldn't get in there because it was a VIP room and you needed to get a pass to get in there.
Oh, one of those.
That bit people don't talk about anymore.
Right.
So it became exclusive to get into the chill out lounge, the white room we called it, which was basically what Killing Joke,
KLF's
first album's called.
Yep.
The White Room. It's all done in such a way that it's spontaneity. Moving that to a stadium crowd was, the crowds really liked what we were doing for it to work.
Yep.
It would never have worked. We played Woodstock 2 in 94, and we closed Woodstock after Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, I read about that. I mean, that's just insane, right?
Work that one out.
How did you go down with the crowd there?
Well, we got was, you know, the Americans at that point, Orbis Terrarum had just come out, and the British press, bless them, hated us. Right. There's always going to be a backlash when you become big. There's always going to be a backlash.
Of course.
Isn't that,
of course.
It's inevitable. But in America, we suddenly became, that was the album for the Americans. That was the album that everyone got and understood as Orbis Terrarum. I just went with that. But I didn't move to America. I wasn't that stupid.
Right.
I stuck to my guns and did an album with lots of mad drum and bass bits, but slowed it down to 40 BPMs rather than 80 BPMs.
Okay.
And that became Oblivion, which put us back on the map again for a while. But then the record label really did try to kill us. They didn't release anything for 4 years. Imagine that.
Universal, that is.
Yeah, Universal. They really didn't like us. They didn't understand us. They didn't want us on the label. And Mapster didn't help very much either. There was a whole revolution of sampling things illegally and making music became cheap as dog food.
Yeah, ironically enough. Hang on a sec, though. You've got to answer my question about Woodstock. How did you go down with the crowd going on after Peter Gabriel? Like, what was that gig actually like?
Well, we did two gigs because we played on the Friday night. It's a thing called Rave Stock.
Sure.
With Orbital and Aphex Twin.
Mm-hmm.
That was more, to us, that was more like the Woodstock from 69 when you're just all the hippies. And there was like a big, huge smoking arena. And this big bong that you could, it had like 20 pipes coming off it.
Okay.
And people in a circle. It is stunning. I mean, as a smoker, that was just like, whoa, this is the life, this is proper. I spent most of the time laughing at my bass player because he was shitting himself all the way through that because he didn't know what to do. Count yourself in Blue Room, on the one. He was always coming in on the four, bless him. And it's such an intricate bass line. And he was always hiding behind the bass. These are the things I remember from that gig.
Right.
But it's the Friday Nights gig, it was post-apocalyptic. It was fires.
It was really muddy, wasn't it?
And campsites everywhere. It was just... And we just... We didn't go through the... We went through the motions on Sunday because I think we all wanted to get out of there by that point. Because we spent the whole weekend at Woodstock for obvious reasons that you just couldn't... You get out there and come back again, it'd take you like 10 hours.
Right.
Did I answer your question now?
Well, no, because you haven't talked about going on after Peter Gabriel. So did they like you?
Oh, right, yeah, they did like us. Yeah, there was nothing... I mean, I think Peter Gabriel liked us. There was another thing that got me was that to my left, looking across the stage, there was the bloke out of Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Carlos Santana and Thomas Feldman all dancing to Perpetual Dawn at the same time. And that gave me the biggest giggle of all.
Nice.
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
Little moments.
That's a good answer, yeah.
Thank you very much. It took me, but you're talking about things that are over 30 years old.
So no, I know, I realise.
Well, it's actually 30 years old this year.
Yeah.
94, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Blimey. It's half a lifetime.
Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, Napster, obviously that's a car crash that, you know, came pretty close to destroying the whole recorded music industry. You were already in this dispute, or did you eventually get dropped by Universal? What actually happened? What was the resolution?
Yeah, they dropped us. They dropped us in 2001.
Okay. And they might as well have done 5 years earlier. It was nice of them, wasn't it?
If you could have done 97, it made it a lot easier for us.
Yeah.
They were, as far as I was concerned, those major record labels were trying to destroy dance music because none of them understood what Underworld, what to lesser or greater degree, even though they did have a frontman with Prodigy. It was mainly dance bands that just had... It was a DJ and an engineer. Mm. That's how it worked. And they couldn't market it. They couldn't market that. They needed to have a pretty boy singer and a pretty boy guitarist.
Sure.
Didn't work in their little heads. They couldn't understand it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, because I suppose it had... You just named those bands, and I guess, like, the kind of...
Aphex Twin.
Big acts. Well, I guess Aphex Twin, no, he never... He was always on Warp, wasn't he? He never signed to a major, but, I mean... Yeah, Underworld did and Orbital did, didn't they, as well? And I guess it was just a case of, you know, the majors doing what they always do, which is trying to commodify a social movement, I suppose, which is what it was, right, over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they always do. And they always end up nearly or actually ruining it, right?
Yeah. And that's what they were trying to do back in 97 to 2001 for us anyway.
Yeah.
And to a lesser or greater degree, you'll see that most of the other bands were suffering as well.
I want to go back. I've realised I missed a key question I wanted to ask you, which was when Acid House first began to happen, what was your initial reaction to it? So first of all, when did you first become aware that this thing might be happening?
87, I was... getting these cassettes from New York. There's a chill out show. There's three different radio stations. The main one being Kiss FM, 98.7 Kiss FM out of New York. This is where Kiss FM London got all their logos from. Everything they used comes from Kiss FM New York, 98.7 Kiss FM. Chill out. And then I'm going to always never remember that the really brilliant DJ is still around now, but he was doing house music then. And for the first, I would have an hour and a half cassette sent every week from the label in New York. Because this was part of my job.
EG.
Yeah, part of my job was send me these mixes because I want to see what's going on.
Yeah.
Personal pleasure as well. No, it's not coming to me, this name. Sorry. It's going to happen after we've done the interview. I'm really, really...
Of course it is, yeah.
but in 87, which is a long time ago, I mean, I was sitting in the kitchen with a Ghetto Blaster listening to this, and in the front room, all my mates were listening to music that wasn't house music, but it was dance music. And a couple of them came into the kitchen, were all on drugs. They sat down on the floor in the kitchen with me, listening to this house music, which they'd never heard before. And they're going, this is all right, this stuff, isn't it? It's fucking brilliant, man. It's fucking brilliant. And I've been watching things like Watch His Mother at the same time as a visual effect while listening to this.
The classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
That's when I first became aware of it.
Right.
My flatmate at the time, Youth, listening to this Kiss FM tape, and then the last half hour became... I'm going to remember his name in a minute. Tall, really cool black dude, basically. This is annoying. Anyway, you're talking nearly 50 years ago now.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely.
Wow. So he changed my life in that sense, that DJ, because that's what I really wanted to. I wanted to find out source where the hell all this was coming from. Larry Heard, Fingers Inc., was one of those main players.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because what happened there was I got myself a ticket to Chicago to see if I could get Larry Heard's publishing for EG Records. And I got
Oh, really? Okay.
This is one of those little jobs that EG went, yeah, yeah, you could do that. Brought all of these tapes of his new recordings by the year. And no, we're not interested. But I just...
God.
But luckily, I had my own record label, so it wasn't all lost.
Sure. So did you, when you went to Chicago, did you go out? Did you go to any of the clubs?
I did, yeah. I went to a dance. I mean, I went to Big Paul, the drummer from Killing Joke, was living in New York.
Right.
And the usual thing with Paul has been not aggressive, but he would get himself in really, really tight situations. I've turned around and he's been thrown out by the bouncers and he's not even got in. So I thought, should I go in and just enjoy myself or should I go back with him? I thought, no, I'm going inside, I'm going to enjoy myself. I'm on the dance floor, I hear Loving You, Huge Ever Growing, on the dance floor, on my own in New York. Nobody knows who I am and what's going on, but I really enjoyed listening to that tune in a completely different environment. It was very odd. And that was in the 80s, so...
And do you remember the first time you went to a rave, quote unquote, like a proper rave? Were you playing or were you in the audience? Or do you remember the first time you walked into one of those events?
I mean, that's kind of because of the Jimmy KLF thing, we got into all the rave things quite early.
Yeah.
And I was going as a DJ.
Yeah.
Because all the whole things that have been the house music, everything was... I was building up an array of music that no one else had at that point. I'm having an argument with one of my best mates, him telling me that he got a better record collection, and how come you get a scene to get... Like, people wanted to come and see me play a house set, and why are they not coming to listen to him?
Right.
The things you have to go through to get to that point in time where people appreciate what you're doing is a rivalry. Friendly or unfriendly rivalry, whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely.
I remember the other DJ now, Shep Pettibone, but there's another one still. There's another one coming in. I know that Shep isn't the one, but he was the one because he ended up producing Madonna, of all people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's some amazing... his mixes, the club mixes he did of tons of tracks in that era. Yeah, amazing. Really amazing.
And the Latin Rascals, that was from 88 as well. That was... I'm getting it because I've got this bloke's face and everything apart from his name, which is really annoying.
Tell me, in your recollection, was the social movement, in quotation marks, of acid house, was that as much of a thing as is commonly kind of made out? Do you remember it being that being a really noticeable aspect of that musical movement?
It was a bit like punk, really. It was something that you didn't really put a name to it. You just went along and enjoyed with it with other people, and you just felt privileged to be part of it.
Mm.
When we were doing Heaven, we were told off by Oakenfold. Basically, said we nearly lost our job the first week
Right.
Where Jimmy turned up with his police car. And he can be able to do this now. What's going on?
Police car. Okay, he drove a police car, didn't he? God, I remember.
An American police car. Yeah. But it was customised to light up and make funny noises. End of the gig, we decided to get in the police car, and there's shark teeth under the bonnet and stuff like that, and the sirens go on and everything. So we've done that. Going round Trafalgar Square. You can't even go round it now. We're going round Trafalgar Square. First bit round, look round, and there's like ravers in cars following us, everybody out the windows waving. And Oakenfold said, we nearly lost our licence because of what you did just then. Please don't ever do it again or else I have to fire you. Sorry, Oakie. Whoops. Anyway, we weren't looking at it. It was just one of those things that we were all kind of chat in common after raving on a Sunday. People would be chilling out quite naturally because they're all coming down from Class A drug.
Yep.
And they're not all going out there trying to rape and pillage and kill people. They're actually having a good time, which the government didn't like that. It really didn't like that because there was nothing to pinpoint a problem. So they have to make their own problems.
Sure.
It's a bit like what they did with the mimers.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they did about five years later with the football fans at Hillsborough.
Yep.
They instigated the whole thing and made it look like it wasn't. There was something, there was nothing going on, but they made sure that it was. Yeah, I don't think they've really changed the old bull either.
No, I think that's a fair comment, to be honest.
No, they haven't. They pretend to think they have. But
There's been however many reports, you know, those big reports, which are always damning and never seem to lead to any kind of tangible change, right?
No, we don't do any racial profiling. No, there's no such thing as racial profiling. Yes, there is, you know.
Yeah, totally. So, okay, just going back to the live thing, I mean, last few things, just to kind of start to finish up, but with the live show, which developed, there was a very prominent visual element to it. And you always seem to get compared to Pink Floyd. Going back to the coverage back then, all the interviews and stuff, it's constant references like the kind of ambient Pink Floyd or the dance music Pink Floyd or whatever. How did you guys feel about that at the time? Was that good or was that like, what the fuck?
The former, what the fuck. I mean, I used to wear, I hate Pink Floyd t-shirts when I was little. As a punk.
I was going to say, it didn't seem to be like quite up your street, right? As a kind of former punk and all that.
No. It's still going on today. I mean, it's a big association with Pink Floyd too.
Well, of course, you have worked with David Gilmour, which is obviously fanning the flames a little bit.
Now, we say we've worked with him, but I would say it's a bit of a tall answer, worked with him.
Right.
Without making it sound like I'm being, here's a story for you, but I wish you'd have been contributed more to the second version of Metallic Spheres than he did.
Right.
Let's put it nicely. I mean, I've known, there's Guy Pratt, who's a bass player with Pink Floyd now, who took over from Roger Waters. Again, I went to school with him. So this is kind of, who don't you know? I mean, you produced the last Pink Floyd album.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that I have. But it's ask me a question. See if I can answer it truthfully without trying to tiptoe around the outside of one. it's politically. Is it Pink Floyd anymore?
Well, yeah. I mean, arguably not without Roger Waters, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
But I mean, going back to the original question, were you guys conscious of being, I guess, built up into this quote-unquote prog dance act? I mean, that's the kind of implication, right, of being compared to Pink Floyd. And, you know, notwithstanding that actual association, like, was kind of being built up into that thing something that you were comfortable with at the time?
We didn't really see it as the orb was going to be anything to do with Pink Floyd. originally, it's the media hype that built up that kind of, like, maybe the Melody Maker, for example, using the front cover, and then have a picture of myself and Gilmore on the front cover of the Melody Maker, and then making a T-shirt out of it, and then you can buy the T-shirt. But that's just all kind of media hype.
Sure. That's kind of what I mean, yeah. I mean, to what extent were you comfortable with all that?
Not very comfortable. For one, I think we made nowhere near as much money as them by a country mile.
Right.
Nowhere near as much money as them. But out of it, all those members of the band, Rick Wright was the one who took notice of what we were doing.
Right.
More than any other members of the band, and unfortunately he's not with us anymore.
Yeah.
But he, as an independent artist, asked us to come along and do a remix for him, which I was really blown away by, to be honest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he's a damn good keyboard player. And they all are, in their own way. They're all very, very, very talented musicians. That's why they're Pink Floyd.
I mean, yeah, of course, yeah.
Were Pink Floyd, even.
Okay, let me ask you a couple more to finish up, a couple more specific ones to finish up. First of all, you were DJing in Berlin the night the wall came down. Is that right? tell me about that.
Tell you about that?
Yes, please.
Okay. It was another one of those nights where EG... Ta-da! Has said, okay, we're going to release one of your bands is going to come out on EG called Marathon, which involved Morris von Oswald. That's his little baby. And so we decided to go over to Berlin with a load of British journalists to do a lot, like a weekend of going around clubs and listening to Sun Electric and this other Gabby, who was in DAF, and he had another band that didn't do so well, but they were on, these were all, if they weren't on EG, they were on WOW Modo, which is our own label.
Sure.
So we had the weekend where we were going down to going over to Berlin, and I got myself a DJing gig at the UFO Club in Berlin.
Which was one of the legendary clubs of that era.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And there we were. Then the wall came down. and everything changed.
I mean, come on. Like, what? I mean, was it apparent during the day, like when you arrived, that shit was about to go down?
We'd heard rumours that something was going on in the East.
Right.
Prior to that, Killing Joke had done an album at Handa Studios, a legendary studio where Bowie had done Heroes and Low.
Yep.
An amazing studio. And there we are. Thomas had worked in there with Depeche Mode. I'd worked in there with Killing Joke. So we knew this studio really well, and it was right by the wall. We heard that this was something weird was going on. So we went down to have a beer at Hansa Studios, and then walk along the wall to see what was happening at I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, the centre of Berlin.
Yeah, Brandenburg Gate.
Yeah, Brandenburg Gate and the Reichstag. So there we were.
Yeah.
And it's any time I never really thought, I wish I could speak German.
Right.
It really was. Yeah. It was just like this bloke standing on the wall with a guitar singing, and everyone's singing with him. And this is the point, the wall hadn't been taken down, but you could hear all these people singing the same song behind the wall.
Wow.
There's people behind there who...
And like a couple of days earlier, everyone would have been shot for doing that, presumably,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You got it. They could quite easily have been shot then. Suddenly, there's a load of East German... army just all stood up on the wall all the way along. Wow. From the part where we are from Brandenburg to the Reichstag and going down to Hansa Studios. And then somebody with an axe came along and started knocking a clunk out of the wall. And it Someone was doing that from the east side as well. A lot of cheering going on, and we just watched. The funniest thing that happened was that one of the bits of the wall was coming down, and you could see there was loads of press there, was loads of like people filming it, and the Japanese got there late, so they asked them to put the wall back so they could film it coming down again. It was fucking hilarious. You can't make this shit up. And Thomas, as a witness, would back me up on that one, because we were there together with our jaws open. They're putting the wall back. Oh, the Japanese have arrived. Oh, look, they've taken it down again. Come on. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, that was peak Japanese hegemony, wasn't it? 1989.
Yeah.
Like, that was the Japanese were going to rule the world then, weren't they, I guess?
Well, yeah, well, they're Sony TVs. What I was watching, the actual moon landings on when I was little, was a little 7-inch black and white Sony TV.
Absolutely.
Back in the day.
So what was UFO like as a club?
It's like a bar. Smelly.
Small little place, right?
Small little place, full of beautiful women and lots of... Berlin was always full of beautiful women. It was just the way Berlin was. What was it like? They gave away 3 bottles of beer, which I kept for years and years and years, because it had UFO on it.
Right.
Picture of a UFO as a beer, the label for the beer. And unfortunately, over this mist of time, the actual sticker came off. It was no more. That was used to be my pride of place and on my shelf for years. The UFO. I mean, that was a moment. I could tell people that now, and they just go, "What, you were there?" Yep. He says one of those you were there moments, basically.
Yeah, it's arguably the most pivotal moment of the last 50 years of history, right?
Yeah, for sure.
You could quite easily argue that, yeah. Amazing. Listen, last question. I know you're a Chelsea fan. Should Maurizio Pochettino be sacked at this point?
No.
Okay. Listen, Alex, this has been great. Thanks so much for your time, man. I've been a huge fan of yours since I was a kid, so it's great to talk to you.
Okay. I still wish I could remember the name of that bloody brilliant DJ from 1987.
Well, if you remember it, then...
Which is Chet Pettibone's mate, but it's really annoying. Still really... Anyway, I know I remember it. As I said, I'll remember it later on, some point this afternoon when I'm listening to something else.
In the bath later, you absolutely will, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, mate, wicked.
Take it easy.
Yeah, that was Alex Patterson. Now, the DJ he was trying to remember the name of, we subsequently realised, was Tony Humphries. So that's who he was talking about there. And say no more. Tony Humphries, clearly a legend. And wow, as I mentioned up the top, some pretty crazy stuff in there. I was hoping to get more football chat out of him at the end there. But, you know, he wasn't biting. We've been going for a while. I mentioned at the top I had to chop this down to get it into more of a listenable shape. So, you know, fair enough. Just for those who don't know, Maurizio Pochettino is the current manager of Chelsea and, in my opinion, should be sacked and should have been sacked days ago. But, you know, frankly, as an Arsenal fan, I'm quite happy for him to stay in his position. So, yeah. Anyway, this was a great conversation, I thought. It was... In places a little bit difficult, in places a little bit, you know, I guess difficult to drill down because of the, you know, the lengths of time that we're talking about here. And the fact that, you know, someone like Alex has been interviewed so many times and is a little bit jaded with it, I think took a little bit of time to warm to me, maybe. But I think we got there in the end. I do think we got there in the end. And wow, that story about DJing in Berlin the night the wall came down, that's crazy, isn't it? It really is. Anyway, this has been a fun episode. It's great to have an absolute legend like Alex Patterson on the podcast. And we've got lots of great guests coming up for the next few weeks too. So I will see you back here, same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Let's go. Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.